Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Today we begin the show by learning more about the complicated life of Jim Thorpe, who probably the greatest, maybe the greatest athlete ever, certainly I think the greatest athlete of his time. And here to tell us the story is David Marinus. He is the author of Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe. David's also written several other books on the New York Times bestselling list. He's an associate editor at the Washington Post. Great to have him back. And as we talk with David, I hope you'll join in with your questions, comments as we move along. What are your stories? What are the stories you've heard about Jim Thorpe, perhaps? What questions do you have about his life? Maybe who is your biggest sports hero? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. David Marinus, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks, Larry. I know you've got a much bigger sports story going on out there today, but happy to talk with you.
Well, we'll be talking about that in about 40 minutes or so. But I tell you what, the Jim Thorpe story, it was your book is an amazing book. Thank you so much for writing it. And I've read your other sports books as well. And I think I interviewed you about your biography on Vince Lombardi and and also Roberto Clemente. And here's this third guy. And I'm, you know, as I've read all the books, and I'm trying to decide what they all have in common and maybe why you chose to write about Jim Thorpe. But there's some similarities and there's some differences among those three.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm glad you asked that question because it's really the reason I wrote the book. I sort of consider it the third book in a trilogy of sports biographies about sports figures who transcend sports. You know, I mean, Lombardi was more than just a great football coach. I saw him as a way to write about the mythology of competition and success in American life and what it takes and what it costs. With Clemente, not just a beautiful ball player, but a way to study the Latino experience on the mainland and also to write about someone, that rare athlete who truly was heroic.
Great, you know, human being.
So many athletes are called heroes and almost none really are. But Clemente lived out his life's motto, which was, if you have a chance to help others and fail to do so, you're wasting your time on this earth. And he died trying to deliver humanitarian aid to Nicaragua after an earthquake and a plane crash. So then along comes Thorpe. And I saw this not just as a chance to write about an athlete of unparalleled achievements, but also a way to explore the Native American experience through his life. And that's really what drew me to them. So they do have things in common, strong willpower, overcoming obstacles to achieve great success. But what I really saw is a way for each of those books to illuminate history and sociology through the story, just a heck of a story about sports.
Yeah, it's a heck of a story. Well, Thorpe was obviously an outstanding athlete, and you look at his experiences growing up, and through his life, frankly, that are very mirror or similar to, at least, the lives of many other Native Americans.
Oh, absolutely. And that's really, I think that you can see in it, through his life, most of the obstacles that Native Americans faced. I mean, coincidentally, Larry, he was born in 1887, the very year of a seminal government act against Native Americans, the Dawes Act, which was an effort to take away their communal properties and turn them into, you know, as part of the process of making them absorbed into white culture, making them private landowners, which was really sort of a scam, and they lost most of that land in the end anyway. Starting with that, all the way through his experiences at the Indian boarding schools, which is so much of a prominent factor in his life and the life of, and the legacy of so many Native Americans today, their parents and grandparents going through that process, through the stereotypes that he dealt with. You know, almost all Native Americans through white society are romanticized on one hand and diminished on the other at the same time. And that certainly was true with Jim Thorpe.
Yeah, it was indeed. Talk about his time at the boarding schools. I think he went, what, he was 6 or 7 years old or something like that when he first...
Yeah, he went to 3 boarding schools. The first one was, you know, he was from the Sac and Fox Nation in Indian Territory of what became Oklahoma. So his first boarding school was at the Sac and Fox boarding school in Stroud, Oklahoma. And actually there he was with his twin brother. Most people don't realize that Jim Thorpe was a twin. His brother Charlie went there with him. And sadly, Charlie died there when a disease swept through the boarding school, which was very common at many of these boarding schools. So at age 9, Charlie was gone. Then Jim alone went to the Haskell Institute in Lawrence, Kansas, another Indian boarding school, where he would run away several times, as did many of the young Native students. And finally, at age 16, his father and stepmother sent him further away, so he couldn't run back home, to the Carlisle Indian Boarding School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and it's there. And he wasn't, I don't know that he exhibited prior to that time a whole lot of athletic ability. But he was kind of discovered there, was he not?
Yeah, I mean, he grew to love football at Haskell when he was 11 to 13 years old. Haskell had a good football team. But think about this. Thorpe arrived at Carlisle at age 16, and according to the records, he stood 5'5 and weighed 115 pounds. So there was a huge growth spurt after that. And it wasn't really, that was 1904 when he got there. And then in 1907, he was discovered, quote unquote, when he was working on the farm at the school and walked by the track, saw the high jumpers trying to clear the bar at about 6 feet, failing to do so. Jim Thorpe in his overalls easily cleared the bar, and the next day he was on the track team, and pretty soon he was the star football player as well.
And that's where Pop Warner comes in.
Yes, Pop Warner was both the track and field coach and the football coach, and a brilliant coach in so many ways, innovative, inspirational, a real trickster and tinkerer. You know, he was one of the first college football coaches to implement the forward pass, which was only legalized in 1905 while he was there. He had a lot of other designs that became part of football lore, but he was not a great human being, as we'll see later.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, his time there led to eventually to the Olympics.
Oh, absolutely, yes. He was the star of the track and field team. He and a long-distance runner named Louis Tuanima, and they both made the 1912 American Olympic team that went to Stockholm, Sweden. And Thorpe there dominated the Olympics. I mean, over a course of a little more than 2 weeks, he competed in what would be, you could call 15 events, because he competed in the pentathlon, which was 5 events, and then the decathlon, which was 10 events. And he won them both by huge margins, larger than anybody has before or since. And at the end of that, the King of Sweden, King Gustav V, said something on the variation of, "You, sir, are the most wonderful athlete in the world." And he truly was considered that at that point. He became world famous after those 1912 Olympics.
And I should also mention before that, I want to go back to that. It was a question I was going to ask, and then it just slipped out of my head. He played, when he was at Carlisle, they played Yale and Harvard and Penn.
Yeah, well, you know, in that era, it wasn't Alabama and LSU and Oklahoma and Ohio State that were the powers. It was the Ivy League schools plus West Point and Syracuse, basically. So those are the teams that Carlisle played, this little Indian industrial school. And there's so many fascinating aspects to that. First of all, Carlisle was a really good team, and they could beat almost all of those schools and did. Secondly, the whole notion of Carlisle was an effort at forced assimilation. The motto of the school was "Kill the Indian, save the man," which means rid them of all of their Indianness, you know, their language, their religion, their culture, shear their braids and dress them in the uniforms of the U.S. Cavalry. All of that is an effort to make them as white as possible. And yet, as an Indian football team, they were considered extremely exotic and popular. So they would go to all these schools. They'd go to Harvard and Penn and Princeton, and huge crowds would turn out to watch these exotic Indians who were playing for a school that was trying to rid them of that very Indianness. It's just a paradox of those times. But they were great. And they beat all of those teams.
Oh, well, there's a great story about West Point.
Yes.
Which I love that story. When here they are playing West Point.
Oh, yeah. It was November 9th, 1912. The Carlisle Indians against the Army. Indians against the Army. what I call the greatest act of athletic retribution in American history, because the Carlisle Indians thumped Army 27-6. And on that Army team was none other than a future president, Dwight David Eisenhower, who was a running back and linebacker for West Point. And, you know, it was football has always been a violent sport, as we see, you know, even this week with, you know, the injury to Tua and everybody.
Yeah.
But it was even more violent then. And Eisenhower later acknowledged that his mission in that game was to knock Thorpe out of the game. with a teammate, they tried to hit him high and low and knock him out of the game, knock him unconscious. They did get him to the ground, but he groggily got up and kept playing and played brilliantly and eventually knocked Eisenhower out of the game. And the Indians won 27-6. Only about a mile from General William Armstrong Custer's tomb at West Point.
And I think Patton was on that team too, wasn't he?
No, Omar Bradley was.
Right.
Patton is another story who also intersected with Jim Thorpe that very same year. He was on the Olympic team. And Patton competed in an event called the Modern Pentathlon, which was a series of military-style events. Yeah. The fencing and equestrian and target shooting.
Jim and Stoughton, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, first, just a fascinating book, and I haven't quite finished it, but you started to touch on something that intrigued me, was the relationships he had and the, I'm not sure if you'd say, duplicitous nature of many of the people in his life, whether it's from Pop Warner to Avery Brundage to his superintendents at Carlisle or team owners for many of the baseball teams that would play him and cut him. And all these people seem to have such an impact or affect his life in different directions, but I couldn't tell kind of what his reaction to all that was.
That's a good way of asking that question. And for those who don't know, after Thorpe competed in the Olympics, his medals were taken away from him because he had played minor league baseball, Bush League baseball, in the Eastern Carolina League for two summers at about $2 a game or $30 a month. And after that was revealed in a story in the Worcester Telegram in Massachusetts, three important people lied about their knowledge of it to save their own reputations. One of those was the famed, the famed coach of that team, Pop Warner, who knew exactly what Thorpe was doing, had been sending Carlisle Indian athletes to play baseball for years before that. And yet he and the superintendent at Carlisle, Moses Friedman, also feigned ignorance of it and were responsible for sending those medals back, along with James E. Sullivan, the head of the American Olympic Committee and of the Amateur Athletic Union, who also happened to be on the board of advisors to the Carlisle Athletic Association. And he, too, knew and denied knowledge of it to save his own reputation. So that's just one of those examples that you mentioned of people in power sort of turning their backs on Thorpe. Now, how did he react to that? Well, it's complicated. He had sort of a codependence with Pop Warner, and that continued through the years after that. Warner helped him get into Major League Baseball, and had a relationship of sorts with Thorpe for the rest of his life. But Jim basically, after he lost those medals, just kept going in sports. And you know, athletes tend to just think about what they're doing at that moment. It was only after his athletic career was over, in the last 20 or so years of his life, that Jim really started to focus on how the injustices that were done to him, and was, if not soured by it, you know, upset at the way he had been treated over all of that period.
Jim, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, with your own questions or comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest today, David Marinus, talking about his book about Jim Thorpe. I'm Larry Mueller. Clara Neipert, our producer today, by the way. Trina LaSousa is our engineer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we talk with David Marinus about his new book, Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe. Again, you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@WPR.org. I don't want to escape talking about Avery Brundage as well. I a couple of people who were really terrible people, really, I think, were Pop Warner and Avery Brundage. Talk about
Brundage even more so than Pop Warner. I mean, and it's not just what happened, well, how he dealt with Jim Thorpe, but, you know, I mean, Brundage's whole history, you know, is pretty sour, going back to 1936 when he sort of supported the Nazi propaganda, claiming that Jews were being treated fine in Germany before the Berlin Olympics of that year, which is really repellent. But his relationship with Thorpe was fascinating. You know, I tend to think of Avery Brundage as this sort of plutocrat, big shot, staying in fancy hotels in Europe as the head of the International Olympic Committee. He was actually a decathlete himself in 1912, a teammate and competitor with Jim Thorpe. And he got crushed by Thorpe in those Olympics and actually dropped out of the decathlon after eight events. And then as Brundage rose through the ranks, first as the head of the U.S. Olympic Committee, and then as the president of the International Olympic Committee, he consistently, over many decades, refused to acknowledge the injustice that had been done to Jim Thorpe and refused to let him get back his records and his medals.
And, you know, losing, he played for the Eastern Carolina, in the Eastern Carolina League. And as you say, a lot of people knew he was playing in that league. And I don't think he understood the ramifications of playing there. But there were a lot of people who played in that league who just chose to go under another name.
Oh, absolutely. There were so many aliases in the Eastern Carolina League. They called it the Pocahontas League because everyone was named John Smith. It was very common for good college athletes, whether they were football players or some other sport, to play baseball for a little bit of money in the summers during that period. Even Dwight Eisenhower, who I mentioned played at West Point, before that, he had played baseball in the Kansas State League under the name Wilson. So it was very common. That's just one of the many factors. You had the hypocrisy of the people in power who knew about what Jim Thorpe was doing. You had the fact that so many people were playing under aliases, whereas Jim Thorpe played under the name Jim Thorpe. He never tried to hide it. And then you have the question, which I think is at the center of it all, Larry, which is what is an amateur and what's a professional? You know, we talked about George Patton, who was in the Army competing in the Olympics in military-style events. He was being paid by the U.S. Army to train for all those events. Was he an amateur or was he a professional? Jim Thorpe was playing baseball, which had nothing to do with the events he competed in. The entire Swedish national team was given a leave of absence with pay 6 months before the Olympics started so they could train, Were they professionals or were they amateurs? There's so many questions like that. This is even before the era, you know, of the Soviet teams being basically paid to practice and being called amateurs. So from the very start, the questions about what was an amateur and what was a professional was right at the center of this issue. And then finally, there's one little technical fact, which is that the Olympic rules stated that to file a challenge against someone's amateurism, it had to be filed within 30 days after the Olympics ended. And the challenge to Thorpe was filed 6 months later. So even technically, it was an injustice, along with the moral injustice of it and the hypocrisy.
So why? Why did it happen? Does it have to do with the way sports was covered? It was a different time.
I think that Jim Thorpe was a convenient fall guy. I'm not saying that it was entirely because he was a Native American, but that certainly was one factor. And the whole system was being propped up. It was semi-corrupt. And so they couldn't let everything fall. So they just threw Jim Thorpe to the wolves.
Yeah. It's such a sad time in his life. Changed so much after that. I guess he went on to play baseball.
He played baseball and professional football after that, and was a pretty good baseball player. Not as good in baseball by any means as he was in football. Certainly better than Michael Jordan was when he tried to change sports. But in football, Thorpe was the first great pro at a time when the professional football was not even a shadow of what it is today. It was a ragtag league. Where players could bounce from team to team every week, depending on who'd pay them the most. But Thorpe sort of solidified the league, and football historians would say that when he joined the Canton Bulldogs in 1915, it really was the start of the rise of professional football. He was so popular that he was made the first president of what would become the National Football League, not because he could administrate, but because his name was the best known by far. So he had all of that going for him after he lost the medals. But then his life started to decline slowly. He struggled with alcoholism. He was always on the road. He ended up with three wives because the first two divorced him because of his drinking and the fact that he wasn't around enough. He had seven children who later became very successful and grew to admire him. But during their early years, they barely knew him. And there's a story in the book where he visits Haskell Institute in Kansas to perform at halftime. And his youngest daughter, Grace, is a student there. And he said he had to reintroduce himself to her. She didn't even recognize him. So there were those sorts of struggles that he had after his playing career.
Let's take a call from Don in Bayfield County next. Don, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. What is Mr. Thorpe's gold medals for the Olympics? And where are they? Who's got them? And can I buy them?
You can't buy them. That's a very good question. His children in 1983 were given replicas of those gold medals, but not the real thing. That was sort of a half-hearted effort to restore him to full status. It wasn't until this year.
Not long
July
ago.
Of this year that they finally restored all of his records. Most of the medals and the trophies that he won that year are in Lausanne, Switzerland, the headquarters of the International Olympic Committee.
Our guest today, David Marinus, as we talk about his book on Jim Thorpe, I hope you'll join in as well with your questions or comments. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Just back to his football. I mean, I was trying to think of a person, a player who sort of matched his abilities because he did pretty much everything as a football player.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the athlete who matched his abilities in the modern era would be Bo Jackson, who was a great football player, a better baseball player than Thorpe, but didn't compete in the Olympics and win gold medals. But he maybe could have if he'd wanted to. As a football player, it's hard to imagine somebody like Thorpe because he did literally everything. He was not only a great left halfback and a defensive back. The award for the best college defensive back each year is called the Jim Thorpe Award. But he also was a great kicker, a fabulous punter. He could punt in the NFL today, routinely punting at 70 yards, and also a place kicker. So maybe Paul Hornung, in some sense, was a running back and a kicker, but Hornung didn't play defense like Thorpe, so really nobody matched him in all of those ways.
No, I thought about Hornung, too. At least on the football side of things, he was probably about as close as you could could come. Well, his the last section of your book, I don't know, maybe 10 chapters probably, talks about sort of his life after the last years of his life, and he had a terrible life in so many ways. I mean, he dug ditches.
It was a struggle for him. When I was writing those last chapters, I kept hoping something better would happen, and it really doesn't. During the Depression, he needed a job. He took a job digging ditches for a hospital being built in Los Angeles. He often was a greeter at various taverns and restaurants and bars. He traveled from state to state. I document him living in 20 different states, including Wisconsin briefly, in Milwaukee near the end of his life for a couple of months. He worked on the fringes of the studio system in Hollywood for quite a while. He ended up in the LA area around 1930 and stayed there for much of the rest of his life, moving on and off. But an interesting period. He acted in more than 70 movies, although acting in quotes, he was an extra in most of them. Sometimes the billing would say with Jim Thorpe or starring Jim Thorpe, and you can hardly find him in the movie. But he was directed by all of the greats, from John Ford to Frank Capra. He acted with all of the stars of that golden era, and he became a spokesperson for the 200 or so Native Americans who lived in the Southern California area and wanted to be hired. There were so many Westerns being made, and often the studios would hire white people and put grease paint on them and make them Indians. And Thorpe became the spokesperson for the Native Americans saying, hire us, and stop with the negative stereotypes. So that was a difficult period, but he found his self-identity in Hollywood during that era as well.
Yeah. I think if there's anything there, the strength he showed there in as representing other Native Americans in acting was probably, and in some ways, a kind of a highlight.
I think it was. It was a period where he established his self-identity as a Native American in an important way. And I think that was something that became a stronger part of his identity. The older he got, the more further away he got from his athletic greatness. But throughout that period, he struggled to find stability, the right job that could keep him in one place. At age 57, he joined the U.S. Merchant Marines during World War II, was the carpenter on the ship going across the Pacific. And when they arrived in India at the end of their mission, the general at the port there and didn't want to meet the captain of the ship. He wanted to meet the carpenter, Jim Thorpe, So wherever he went, he still had the residue of his fame.
So what do you think, what qualities did Thorpe possess in order to have the kind of the grit to survive the many downs of his life?
Well, it was perseverance. And I talk about this in the sense of do I consider the book a tragedy? Because there are so many tragic elements to it. And so in one sense, you could say it is, but in another sense, I look at it as a story of perseverance and survival. There was a point in 1915 when Thorpe was still at the peak of his powers, when the most famous sculpture in America was called The End of the Trail. There's even a copy of it in Waupun, Wisconsin, among other places now. But it showed an Indian slumped on horseback with a slumped horse. And the notion was that this was the end, that manifest destiny had prevailed and rendered Native Americans an anachronism. They were a dying race. They would soon be dead. There were fewer than 300,000 Native Americans in that early part of the 20th century. But it didn't happen. They figured out ways to survive with all of a system rigged against them. There are now a few million Native Americans. And I look at that as sort of Jim Thorpe being emblematic of that survival. For everything that he had to deal with, his own demons and the societal pressures, he kept going to the end. That family that he created became a legacy. His three of his sons were U.S. military officers. His daughters all got college degrees. The grandchildren and great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren, all successful activists in various ways. And Thorpe is still an important legend in all of Indian country. And so I think that it's a story of survival of his race that he emblemizes.
Yeah. And I think that I can't remember. I guess when I was a kid, I read about Jim Thorpe, but there really hasn't been a lot written about him. I mean, there were kids' stories more.
Almost everybody I talked to when I said I was writing a book about Jim Thorpe said, "Oh, I read about him in fourth grade."
Yeah.
I saw the movie, which is a 1951 movie, Jim Thorpe All-American, starring Burt Lancaster as Jim Thorpe, directed by a great director, Michael Curtiz, who directed Casablanca. So the movie is very sympathetic to Thorpe, but it's wrong in almost every respect. You know, it shows Oklahoma with the San Gabriel Mountains of California in the background. But I mean, that's just one little thing, but all of the chronology is off. Plus, what I found most problematic about it is that it has Pop Warner as the narrator and savior of Jim Thorpe. And when you really know the story of what Warner did to Thorpe, it doesn't ring true at all.
Yeah. And it's sort of a bad end. Talk about his third wife and sort of the end of times with for him.
Well, his third wife, Patsy Thorpe, was his business manager and was, you know, not young and naive like his first two wives, really knew what was going on, but was manipulative. And after Jim died at age 65 in a trailer park in Southern California, he wanted to be buried in Oklahoma. And there was his coffin was taken back there. There was a Sack and Fox ceremony being undertaken when Patsy came in and took the coffin away, saying she was unhappy with how Oklahoma was going to honor him with a mausoleum, and essentially put him up for bids, and was in Philadelphia. And this is just a bizarre story. She was watching television in Philadelphia, saw a TV piece about these two small, struggling coal towns in the Pocono Mountains, Mauch Chunk and East Mauch Chunk, and developed this scheme where she persuaded them that if they merged and changed their name to Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, they could have him. They could have the mausoleum there. And they did that. She also promised them a Jim Thorpe College and a Jim Thorpe Hospital and a teepee hotel. All these things had never materialized, but they did change their names. It's now Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania. That's where you have to go to see his grave. And it's a place where he never set foot in his entire life.
It's such a, and I think his sons tried to get that.
Yeah, Yeah, they filed suit and they won in the federal courts, and then it was overturned in the appeals court. The appeals court said that Patsy Thorpe had the perfect right to do what she did, and the grave didn't fall under the Museum Recovery Act. And then the Supreme Court upheld the appeals court. So legally, it's pretty much over and decided. I have nothing against the people of Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, but I agree with those who say he belongs in Oklahoma, where he was from.
Chris in Madison has a question for us. Let's go there. Chris, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, guys. Great topic. I just have a quick question. I've heard through oral history from Ojibwes that Jim Thorpe was actually related to Blackhawk, and I was just wondering if David had come across that in his research.
And his
absolutely. That's the first chapter of my book.
Yes.
Blackhawk was from the Second Fox Nation, like Jim Thorpe, from the same clan, the Thunder Clan. And it's not totally established, but it appears that Jim Thorpe's grandmother on his father's side, Natinequa, was Blackhawk's grandniece. So there is a relationship. And Jim Thorpe's mother told him that he was the reincarnation of Blackhawk. So Blackhawk was a central figure in Jim Thorpe's identity and self-identity from his very earliest days.
Thanks very much, Chris, for calling. Appreciate it. And David, thank you so much. What do you want readers to gain from your book?
Well, first of all, I want them to just enjoy an incredible story.
It is an incredible story.
But I also, what I wanted them to do, what I hope the book accomplishes, is through this athletic career to really see what it was like for Native Americans during that entire period, from his birth in 1887 with the Dawes Act taking away land to his death in 1953 with the detribalization efforts by the U.S. government and the boarding schools in between. All of these obstacles that were put in the way of Native Americans from feeling their own self-identity.
Always a pleasure, David. Thank you so much for being with us. I hope we have a chance to talk again, maybe about your next book. Thanks.
Okay, Larry. I'll always be there for you.
David Marinus. Yeah, thank you. David Marinus. His book, Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe. It's a fantastic book, and I hope you have a chance to look at it and to read it. Well, speaking of reading, I bet last night, if you're a Wisconsin football fan, you spent a lot of time reading and checking stories on Paul Chryst's firing as head coach of the Badgers. We'll talk about that and some other things with our next guest, Jim Polzin, coming up on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.